episode 15 of season 17, Correcting Greyhound's Bug Harassment. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a pedant curmudgeon and just a generally great guy. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. Today we're going to talk about passwords. We're going to talk about the World Wide Web. We're going to talk about MP3s and Windows 95 versus 98. Lots of things of that nature. But first, I want to start with a correction. Do you recall that we talked a little bit about Uber last week, Miles?
Just a little bit.
We kind of ragged on him a bit. We got a lot of feedback from people saying, ooh. And I agree.
Or somewhat stronger language, but yes.
Definitely. Non-re-arable language. I did have a correction, though, and it's one of the things I said. We talked about how Tim Cook kind of gave a warning to Uber to stop tracking users by incorrectly grabbing the serial number of their phones. And I said that maybe Tim Cook didn't want to stop and push Uber off the App Store because, of course, they're making money. That's not actually the truth. They're not making 30% of the cut of the services of Uber. Because as it's very clear in Apple's policies, they take 30% of commission off of virtual goods. So when you have an app, then you're selling virtual worlds on a game or something, right?
Or selling music or selling something intangible.
Something intangible. Then they take 30%. But if you're selling real goods, it's like the eBay app or something like that, they're not going to take a 30% commission off that.
Or Amazon, for that matter.
Or Amazon. And it's interesting because I was wondering how Amazon had gotten away with doing what they do with their app. And I assumed it's because you made the account somewhere else. But basically, it's because it's real services. So,
however, Amazon does have a separate app for reading on Kindle versus purchasing books, specifically because of this issue. That you, if they had the Kindle app be able to purchase books on iOS, then they would be subject to that 30% fee.
Right. And that was actually one of the things that people were always asking about the streaming, you know, the Amazon streaming app. You can see other things, but if you haven't bought it already, you can't play it on that app. You have to go to the website, and that's the reason.
Well, you can actually go to the app. Oh, wait, maybe you can't do it from the app.
Well, you can't purchase, like, because Prime gives you free free videos and such. But if you want to find something that's pay-per-view, if you will, you can't actually pay through that app. You've got to go remotely, and that's because Apple would take a percentage of that. Any case, I should have known that because I'm an app developer, and I'm involved with a relatively large virtual intangible company, but I didn't know that there was this special thing where if it's real stuff, they don't pay. So Uber does not give a cut of all of its services to Apple. So then here's the question. Why didn't Tim Cook or Apple in general just drop Uber from their store? Might they have caused Apple device sales to decrease over time because of it? Because if all you think of is, oh, I can't buy an iPhone because iPhone doesn't work with Uber, that could reduce the sales over time.
It could. That could be one worry, especially when the conversation was happening, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
So Uber was still up and coming rather than being beaten up by podcast hosts.
Okay, so now, and thanks for the, I'm glad we did the correction. I got a lot of feedback from people, so thank you so much for that. Let's go on to SpaceX. And this, of course, is a story that's not so great for radio. So do your best, Miles.
SpaceX has provided footage of the rocket landing. And it doesn't matter how many times I see it. Even if I watch the old ones, it's still fun to watch over and over again. So when they release a new one, it means that I get to watch that episode over and over and over again.
We're talking about the
second season of Daredevil for me. I just watch it over again.
Do you like the second season of Daredevil?
I do.
Oh, cool. We're talking about, of course, the first stage rocket actually being reused by it piloting down and landing vertical on a pad. And what does this video do that's different than many of the videos we've seen of this nature?
It doesn't. It lands, but you get to watch the rocket land all the way from 150 kilometers above and then come back down again.
We will connect to the today's show page, which, of course, is the May 3rd show, 2017. I have a video of a POV of the rocket, which is kind of cool. Yeah. So it's like a split screen POV.
Although this launch was also somewhat different in that it was a classified satellite that was launched. It was the first time they had access to do that. So I think some of the telemetry for the upper stage was not available because of some secrecy.
Let's now move on to really, really bad passwords.
Sure. This was called out by a Twitter user that was talking about Greyhound.com.
And this Twitter user is PW2Strong?
Or actually, this is Ars Technica talking about it, but I will bring up a Twitter user that handles this scenario quite a bit. In general, sites are, some are good, some are bad. Some are very good with regard to security. Some are atrociously bad.
Mm.
And the most atrociously bad sites tend to be the smaller, they just want to put up a little bit of login, geekspeak.org, that if you had any real scrutiny to it and if you had any public use, it would not be acceptable.
Sure.
But as you get into the larger and larger companies, especially where there's real money changing hands, which there currently isn't, there's no way to enter in your credit card number onto geekspeak.org. So,
hey, you can email us if you want.
For example, Greyhound.com, the bus line service.
They're dealing with millions and millions of dollars, of course, because people are buying bus fare.
Right. And more specifically, not just purchasing for there, but they're having their equivalent of frequent flyer mileage.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Your account can rack it up, and therefore it's worth quite a bit. Are you saying they have a bad password policy?
They have such a bad policy that, in general, this reviewer on Ars Technica was mentioning that they don't talk about it most of the time. There are some bad ones, and they're just like, there's some bad ones, we'll let it slide. But this one was so bad, and the vendor was so large that just couldn't ignore it.
Okay, so what's their policy?
Well, first off, they allow passwords as short as 4 characters, allowing such passwords as would be okay for your example, your luggage from a certain Spaceballs movie.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hey, that's my luggage.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 actually was the Spaceballs reference. 1, 2, 3, 4 is still acceptable on the site. So it's worse than a Spaceballs.
So, I mean, I'm not real familiar with Greyhound. I haven't done it since I was in high school, I think. But I would assume that they're not like, they're not at least displaying your credit card information again if you log into their account, right? I mean, it's not as bad as that, is it?
I don't know their credit card information, how well they hold that. But I do know that if you forget your password, with most sites, you click on a link to say, I forgot my password. It will either ask you some security questions or email you a link to be able to log on to their site again.
A one-time link that will allow you for a short period of time to go and reset your password.
Exactly.
With the idea that the transit to your email is safe enough such that when you get that link and you use it once, you can enter in a new password.
Right.
It's a very common practice.
And then after 2 days, the link expires. It's no longer useful. Someone gets in and tries to do it, right, you know, 2 years down the road. It's an acceptable window.
It's barely acceptable, but depends. But in any case.
As opposed to security questions, which I want to talk about security questions in a little bit, but that's but here, Greyhound was sending an email of the PIN or password with a plain text password.
With your password emailed to you?
Yes. Here's your password.
So that means they're saving your password in clear text.
Right. In general, when you want to save a password, you save it hashed so that when you try to log in, you put in your password, they hash it with the same algorithm again, they should come up with the same result.
And the important point is that hash is non-reversible.
There's a little bit of fudging with that with a salt, but yeah, that's basically the case.
And the hash is non-reversible, so they don't actually know what your password is.
Right.
They know how to check your password.
So if they're sending you the plain text, they're saving it in plain text, which
really
means
bad.
That if
any data breach means you got all the passwords.
Right.
And as we know, people use passwords over and over again. If you use a password at Greyhound.com and you also use it for email, well, they have access to your email as well.
Yep.
Because, of course, the email address is also connected to your Greyhound account. So please, oh, God, so bad.
Right. But this does cover in a couple of other things, which was, for example, number one, the security questions. I'm actually really not okay with security questions anymore.
I'm okay with it because I know that what I put in there is password information. I have now started, I use 1Password, right? And 1Password, I just, every time security questions are asked of me, I write down the security question in my password vault for that site, and then I generate a random word password from the generator, and then I put that as the answer.
Right.
So now my those questions are just extra passwords. Like they have no meaning. They're just completely random.
Sure. And that would be and that's awesome.
But most people don't do that.
Most people don't do that. And in addition to that, there's another wrinkle which has been shown to me on a regular basis now. There are questionnaires that go on Facebook that
that answer these things.
They're supposed to be like, hey, you know, just copy and paste. These are to get to know your friends from high school or whatever.
Right.
And
what
they're
year
fun.
Did you graduate
and
high
they're,
school?
And they're fun. They yeah. are fun. But they are also, by and large, going to contain questions that you use for security questions for many companies.
Right.
Which means that you are publicly broadcasting your security information for someone to reset your password for your email or for your bank account or
you should make a poll for Facebook, Miles, where you just post, what's the last four digits of your social security number? What's your maiden name? What's your pet's first name? What town did you grow up in?
Right. Now, some people might say, but I only post this for friends. I don't have it as public.
You have bots, baby.
Well, there's that. Think about all the friends, assuming that you don't have any bots in your friends list. Which a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Are you sure that your friend, that all of your friends, and that any of your friends have bots in their friends list?
I mean, keep in
mind
that
when you
Facebook
post stuff, they tend to be friends of friends. You know, yep.
And
unless
also
you do friends
Facebook,
except for acquaintances.
Additionally, yeah. Facebook has apps. There's a whole API structure for that. So one of your friends can grant access to their timeline to some service. And they can do that accidentally because their machine was pwned or intentionally because they wanted free
because they
stickers,
wanted Candy Crush.
Whatever. And now all of a sudden there's a bot that's connected to your friend's account that can read everything they can read and it's automated and it's checking things. The other thing is these security questions are silly, right? I mean, if you had a high school reunion, you went to the high school reunion, it's going to be in the town you went to high school in, right? So even if you never posted that, there's pictures of you at your high school reunion. That gives you the date of when you graduated. It gives you all the people you went to high school with. It gives you the town you're in. This automated is really easy to get all the data that any survey would be asked.
Right.
Don't use real information for these questions.
Right. Social
You've
media hasn't really changed the landscape on that.
Yeah. Additionally, it's very common for these security questions to not be encrypted in any form or hashed in any form because an individual normally talks to you on the phone. So it's a very common pattern for, you know, your dog's name. My dog is Higgs Boson, right? For that to be in the database. But when it's entered in, they're not going to care if there's spaces in between. They're not going to care about capitalization. If I said Higgs Boson, they'd be like, oh yeah, that's good. And they'd approve it, right? So it's an individual checking. It's not like a password. So start using it as a password. Just start putting in other things because it's ridiculous to use real data. Real data is too well known.
At least now it is.
So that was your Greyhound story and also your password policy story, right?
Right, except for one of the reasons why that Ars Technica editor or author did not want to post it in general for a lot of sites that fail is there is a Twitter account specifically for calling out bad password practices on website or bad security practices on websites. But in fairness, they also point out when someone is doing it right. And we have a link on that up on our site.
And that account I mentioned earlier is at PW2Strong.
In other words, password is too strong.
Right. Which is great because, of course, lots of times the error you get, I just got this the other day. What was it? What was the site? It oddly enough has something to do with me buying a house, which has to do with a lot of money and a lot of private information. You know, I'm sending documents that are like, all my car information, my spouse's information, my social security number, everything. And they're like, email this information to me. And I'm like, no, I won't email that to you. So I'm learning how to encrypt, files like PDFs you can actually password protect. And then I'm like, call me when you want to do this. And then they call me. I'm just like, okay. And they're like, hi, I'm calling from the bank. I'm like, cool. What information do you have about me? How do I know it's you? They're like, what? And I'm being a little paranoid, but at the same time, it's like my life savings in this transaction. It's kind of important to me.
Yep.
One of these places, I had to put in a password, and I just had one password create a random, 20-digit password, as I normally do, or 20 characters. And I put it in, and they're like, no, you can't have special characters in it. And that response is, your password is too strong. That's what the response means. Sorry, your password is too strong.
And to get into more technical details, stay tuned for the after show when we start digging in deeper Yeah. Right now, we're just doing
overview. You're gonna do that. Yeah. So if you're listening to this on radio, we have a podcast. It's a little bit longer. You can get to it at geekspeak.org. And after the show, pretty regularly, Miles and I get a little geekier. Though last week, I cut off our conversation. I didn't put any of that on there. It was just nice and short.
No, that's fine.
So this week, we're going to geek out a little bit. Yeah. All right, let's talk about the World Wide Web, though.
Well, just this week, specifically April 30th, CERN, which is the European organization that handles Large Hadron Collider, does particle physics, stuff like that, also was the home of the early World Wide Web. The spec for it, Tim Berners-Lee, or Sir Tim Berners-Lee.
At the time, it was just Tim Berners-Lee.
At the time, it was just Tim. Everybody always starts off, a little.
I haven't gotten my knighthood yet.
Right. Unlikely as an American, too.
Oh, thanks a lot.
But it was released into the public domain.
The World Wide Web.
The World Wide Web, the spec for it.
And
HTTP, the protocol, the basic tag structure.
But basically, the HTTP protocol and the HTML protocol, is that kind of
HTTP, the P in HTTP stands for protocol. So HTTP protocol is like saying ATM machine or Sahara Desert.
You know, we just do that.
Yeah, we just do that.
So the HTTP protocol, and that's really hard to say.
That's just wrong.
And the HTML, or HTM language. Those two things were released in the public domain when?
In 1993. April 30th, 1993. And if you want to look at the actual filings, you can go up to our site.
It's a little dry.
Yeah, it is.
A little dry.
But if you want to see, it's a piece of history. It's kind of like looking at the Declaration of Independence. You're like, hey, well, okay, not quite as heady as that. But
you know, the people have said over the years, most recently, that the web is kind of dead in the sense that there's all these apps now, and you're seeing a lot of more data not on the web. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think the web is strong and vibrant?
I believe so. I really don't think it's going away. The fact that we have apps now is an interesting recent development, but I think we're going to start running into one or the other of two possibilities. One, apps are going to become standardized in such a way with a standard platform for development. Where you're defining in a platform non-specific way that you are able to archive it easily.
Right.
But at the same time, apps don't really allow you access to the database that spawned them. They're really standalone.
And there's something really beautiful about just having a port 80 or port 443 and getting an HTML document back and having that be canonical truth of what's there, in the sense that you don't need an API except for the web to get data and save it and archive it and access it. And that's kind of nice in the simplicity.
Well, it's the difference between a spec and an implementation. Mm-hmm. The Amazon app on iOS is an implementation. It is not a spec. Right. There's no multiple versions of that that are competing. As opposed to, when I say a spec, I mean a specification that you're writing to, and the equivalent would be there's Chrome, there's Brave, there's Firefox, there's Edge.
All those things read web.
All of those are browsers, and they all speak the same language, have the same communication protocols, and they are a lingua franca. I mean, they are a common spec, and so that's what you're competing on, but it also means that you are able to get the information in a more universalized, more open way. And when I say this, I say this in terms of you can get a document that's over 20 years old that was made for the web, open it up in a modern web browser, and there may be some breakage. But in general, you can read that document. And in some cases, you can even read that document in where the layout is indistinguishable from when it was originally released.
That's right.
Because backward compatibility has been
with animated GIFs so and everything.
Well. With animated GIFs and everything.
Not 20 years ago, but 17 years ago. I think GIF came out a little bit later.
GIF 89A, yeah, you're right. And so you're talking about when we look at apps and the app environment.
They don't have that longevity.
Right. The concept of viewing the output of an app from 5 years ago, just 5 years ago, is completely unheard of. It's just nonsense.
I had this problem, the same kind of problem when I worked in digital art and new media. I was always installing art. And this art is like computer-driven art with whatever the technology of the day. Lots of projection work, lots of laser cutter work, lots of fun, kind of cool things. But when it came down to how would a museum take that piece of art and add it to their collection and archive it or use it, it becomes extremely difficult to do that with digital art because the machines are just going to fail. The transistors are going to, the caps are going to blow at some point on that computer. Or maybe the entire piece of art is just a software that runs on a machine with a projector on it. Well, that runs on a Windows 98 machine, and eventually it won't run anymore. So that problem became this kind of serious problem in the art space on how do museums figure out how to archive this. And what we just started doing is documenting the experience of seeing the piece, so that at least we had video over time.
See, the thing is,
what it was.
Though, that archive.org is not the original site. That's going to be a scrape of it. I think in your scenario, where as long as they are not connecting up to an active web online archive.
Well, that's the thing. Is some of these art pieces were interactions with Google.
Right,
that
right.
was the art piece, right? So you can't archive it in the same way you can a painting.
Right. You can't archive it in the same way. You would have to do something like whatever its output is, have a video recorder on it and record it that way. Or have something like, oh, well, that machine with Windows 98 is dying. You can emulate a box that runs Windows 98 and run that and go and have the outputs. Because the outputs on systems are also standardized.
Yeah, I agree there is some aspect of that. But, there's situations where there was this great piece that was basically an object you bought. And as soon as you took it home, it connected to Wi-Fi and it listed itself on eBay. And whoever bought it on eBay, you got paid and then you shipped it to them. That was the art piece. It was an art piece that was using the eBay infrastructure to sell itself and to, it was kind of the piece about, it was talking about archive and music and who owns art and that whole aspect. So there's a lot of pieces like that where they don't work without the infrastructure around them. A student that had this great piece about the stock market, and it was basically analysis of all these companies that kind of do harm and then equating those companies' profit and loss to the sins, the seven deadly sins. Mm-hmm. So as McDonald's stock went up, the sin index increased.
Of gluttony.
And so you had, this piece, but of course that piece was based off of a protocol where the site went down, right? So of course you could rewrite it to try to make it work again on the newer stock ticker system, but
art
anyway,
has always been this way. And it's not just, digital art, because you can have art that, for example, a sandcastle is art. And many of the sandcastles in displays or competitions.
There's intent.
And they are ephemeral and that's just the nature of the beast. And there is a case for apps, for some apps anyway, to be ephemeral.
Sure.
But there's a lot of cases, and I'm going to call it right now, Facebook. Facebook absolutely should be archived.
Because the amount of data that's on there for people.
It is a snapshot into culture of our time. Like it is hugely important from a sociological point of view. And its loss, if Facebook went under. I mean, I don't know that it's going to happen anytime soon, but let's say in 15 years that Facebook just didn't have the longevity, something else came up and supplanted it. How do you get access to all that information when it's just controlled by one company?
It's not just the information, it's the infrastructure to make the information connect. It's too big a data set to just say, here's the tables, because the system itself functions in such a way that's too complex for a generic export of it. But let me say one other thing. Another form of art that's very much like this, it's hard to document, is theater. A production of theater is a transient thing. My son recently, was in a relatively large part. I thought it was amazing. Family and friends around that didn't get to see it were like, oh, we got to film it. I'm like, well, that's not what theater is. You can film theater, but it's not the theater experience. So I didn't film it, right? I just was like, nope, it's not going to happen. And mostly because I have a lot of tape of my kids in theater. This is like the 20-second show my son's been in. So it's kind of like, well, where do you stop? Where do you start? Like,
It never stops.
Part of an artistic endeavor is to experience the thing. So, any case, but you were what were we talking about?
Well, you were talking about Facebook and talking about
Facebook,
the database is too large.
It's not too large. I'm not saying it's too large. It is large, massively large, but over time it'll get smaller comparatively. But it's more that what Facebook is not just the data. First off, you've got to render it in some form, right? So you have to have the text and the images and you have to export the concept of reply of a certain message substring, right? And the likes and emotions, you're basically having to implement some kind of viewer for that data. And that implementation of that viewer is not going to be, it's not going to lack some subjectivity. It's going to change what it is.
Yes, I agree with you that some nuance will be lost. But then again, I think a lot of nuance has been lost even among the 20-year-old web.
Sure.
I'm not concerned about arguing about the nuance so much as it's kind of the whole kit and caboodle. Unless someone has taken a screen grab of a specific conversation on Facebook and then posted it someplace else that can be scraped by archive.org, it's gone.
Yeah. You know, a while ago I installed an app that was it was a PHP built app that somebody created that allowed me to make a Facebook app ID and then attach this application, this PHP application, to my Facebook app ID. And then what this app did for me is went and archived all my content into a system that was viewable. And I ran that for a few times. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So because you can't really export Facebook the way you'd think, but you could set up an app to do this. And so someone had done that. I'm sure these things exist. Hey, if you know of this service, please let us know. I'd be curious what the best quality of these are right now, because I'd probably do it again.
Yeah.
And you can contact us at geeks@geekspeak.org.
I do have some sympathy for the view of I don't want necessarily all of my Facebook data to be permanent. This is what gave rise to Snapchat.
Sure. Yeah, there is a question about that. Like, should it be intangible in some way? Just like if you and I have a conversation without the microphones on, it goes away afterwards. And there's something worthwhile about that.
Right.
She references the EU policy and privacy and rights.
But this is a curious thing. When you have something that is marked as friends and maybe friends of friends, that has that thing of I don't want this to be in a public archive. Like, that there is an implicit statement there, an assertion of your intent. But at the same time, don't you want your friends to have access to that archive? And it really does – instead of archive.org being a very blanket, all-or-nothing affair, because we are getting to something that has more nuance, it doesn't make the problem any less relevant or important.
Yes, I agree. I do agree with you at some level that this idea that the Facebook content will go away at some point. I mean, if you think about our culture in general, one of the reasons why we're drawn to the cartoons of our youth or the sitcoms of our youth is that it brings back a nostalgic aspect of who we are. It helped define who we are. You know, as much as you watched or didn't watch The A-Team, it is a part of your psyche at some point if you're in the United States in the 80s. And so that piece of our culture exists. Now, we have tapes of it, and therefore it's kind of there. It's probably available on some streaming service now. So you can go watch it and kind of get the remnants, or you can maybe have an old sweater that has the logo on it. So it's part of your culture. Facebook has a different problem than that. It's like it will only be a part of your culture as long as Facebook, the company, keeps providing the service of accessing that data, which is a weird way of thinking about it. You have to kind of always be attached to that if you want to hold on to the entire archive of your experience on that service. You have to keep on being associated with the service, which makes it's
building
a different
type. Huge amount of cultural inertia. Yeah,
it is. Oh, good point. Cultural inertia. And it's something that, you know, Disney's done for a long time. We've talked about how powerful they are in respect to, you know, they still own, you can't legally republish Mickey Mouse because it's their trademark. And even though it's an important part of
their copyright. Yeah.
Mickey Mouse is also a trademark, but it's oddly in one of those places.
There's,
but
yeah.
Even though it's a complete copy of an earlier cartoon. But let's move on. First off, I want to let you know that you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Miles Elam. He's a programmer. I'm a programmer. We're both parents. He's got goats. I got chickens. You got goats. You got chickens too, don't you?
I have chickens as well. Yeah.
The new house I'm moving to?
Mm-hmm. A lot of space for...
Not so much chickens. No, I won't have chickens.
Why not?
It's going to be really tight to do chickens on that property. It's just really not big enough. It's in Boulder Creek, though. You can contact us and ask us questions and all that. I am on Twitter, and Miles is on Twitter. He is at Miles Elam, all one word, and I am at Lyle, just L-Y-L-E. And Elam is E-L-M-E.
E-L-A-M.
Damn. But you didn't do your first one. M-I-L-L-E-S, right?
Nice.
Miles Elam, at M-I-L-E-S-E-L-E-M. A-M.
You got lucky typing this time.
No, I didn't. Shut up.
When you go to our site, every time you see a typo, it's Lyle.
You really think so?
99.9% of the time.
Tell me all about Windows 95, sir. You have some story about Windows 95 and 98?
I do. Because it is a defunct operating system. It should not be used anymore. And yet, we are using it. We are paying to use it. Because the Pentagon still uses it.
The Pentagon uses 95?
Windows 95 and Windows 98. Along with a fair smattering of Windows XP.
Are you saying that the Pentagon... But the problem is with those two operating systems, 95, 98, and XP, they're not supported by Microsoft anymore.
They are, in fact, because they have a specific contract with Microsoft to continue service on these because they're running critical systems.
Okay, I don't understand something. If the Pentagon is paying Microsoft to keep the software up to date and secure, and therefore Microsoft have patches for these operating systems, why aren't they providing them to everybody?
Because
it's just software.
Because it is for a specific spec that the Pentagon is using. So this is a
hardware
very
spec.
Different hardware spec as well as a software spec. So it is not the same thing as general operating system support that says we're going to support all the drivers that are out there.
Right, right, right.
We're going to support all the different software and all the different pieces that are in there. Like, who knows? Maybe the DoD doesn't need the audio API.
But
you know,
also the driver
there,
support's a perfect example. There's probably only 50 or 60 different printers that the DOJ has created and or is using.
DOD,
right?
Yeah.
DOD. You probably don't need more than X number. You also probably don't need the current printers. It's not like they're buying new printers, right? They're servicing their old laser printers from the 80s and
sure.
Still using them. 90s, probably. Wow. That's kind of impressive that they're still doing that. And it's critical systems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, if it works,
systems.
It works, right?
As long as they are air-gapped.
Meaning no network connection, please.
No network connection whatsoever, because if you ever have these anywhere near a network, your system is taken over in milliseconds.
So you have another story about Pentagon, actually. They're looking for bugs?
Well, this is a report that is saying that the Pentagon should run a bug bounty program, just like commercial businesses.
Describe what a bug bounty is.
A bug bounty is saying, hey, all you computer experts out there, security experts, maybe they're security researchers at universities, maybe they're independents. If you can find vulnerabilities in our software, and then without disclosing them, at least without a certain window of time to patch it, you notify us of the bug, show us a proof of concept of the exploit, as well as showing exactly how it can be affected. For example, is it just a general bug that can cause a crash, which is a denial of service?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it something that can get access to the account that it's logged in as to get access to the documents that are there? Or it is something that would allow privilege escalation, which is actually getting access to the kernel of the system, the root, the administrator.
Allowing you to
user.
Run other applications and such.
Yeah, much more powerful. And we'll pay you money depending upon how severe the problem is. That's the that's the bounty aspect to it. And right now, government doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And one of the things about bug bounties is when people might think, oh, this is going to cost so much to pay out, and only the people like Apple and Google have the money in the deep pockets to be able to do this, aside from the deep pockets of the federal government, there is that aspect of breaches and security flaws will end up costing you more than having people actively trying to find these and safely telling you what they found.
Sure. And it's very common nowadays for companies to provide this service, meaning they offering money. Normally it's an invite only where you kind of, a company will, like Apple will say, hey, we're interested in people looking at our systems and services, and they kind of pre-authorize certain people to look into things. That way they have a smaller group of people looking into it, and then those people will attack and look at ideas. They also make an agreement when they do this that, you know, yeah, we will pay you a bounty if you find something, but these are the rules, right? You can't go and break into our employees' houses and look through their papers. You know, there's policy, there's places around that that are appropriate and not appropriate. And these are really functional because they save a lot of resources for the company because, of course, as you and I both know, it's extremely hard to find bugs in software.
It depends. Depends upon the software.
Well, and the author. Yeah. It'd be really hard for you to find bugs in my software because you can't even spell what I spell.
That's a good point. There's a competition called Pwn to Own. And this is been used for browsers, but it's also used for full machines sometimes. But Pwn to Own, one of the things about it is, when you have, for example, a browser, you have a bunch of people every year, here's a competition, and you send these teams out. Are they able to get into the system? Are they able to break the browser? Are they able to actually start running random code off of a page not supposed to do a cross-site scripting activity? Sure. Are they able to break out of the JavaScript sandbox to get into the browser itself, the browser code? And then are they able to break through that browser sandbox on the operating system and get there? And the years of running this means that the browser security, which is a very wide target.
Sure.
I mean, browsers are
once you win, you get lots of machines.
Well, browsers are also something they're unprecedented in their complexity.
Yeah.
Browsers have a scripting engine built into
JavaScript.
Them, so, yes. That allows arbitrary code in a lot of ways. They have a rendering engine.
HTML, CSS.
Yes. That also loads images. So the image loader
JPEG,
may be
compromised. JPEG, yeah, GIF.
That may be compromised.
SVG, another format, actually.
They have network connections.
Is SVG Turing complete?
The SVG runs JavaScript. So
oh, okay.
In that sense, yeah, sure.
Basically, you're saying this is a very large...
SVG is a document format. Technically, it's a document format, not an image format, but that's a whole other topic of conversation.
Scalable vector graphics is what that's called.
And they also have libraries for Unicode and font rendering and like all of these areas.
Tons of stuff, yeah.
They do basically everything that a computer can do with some restrictions added on rather than the other way around. And they are wonderful with regard to security.
Comparatively to their complexity, yes.
Yeah, yes. Because at Pwn to Own, you have these competitions where they're breaking into, and they still break into the browsers on a regular basis. But these exploits are insanely complex now. They are amazing in their ability to retard invaders.
Right. We're not talking about just guessing someone's password here. We're talking about a lot of complexity.
Yes.
And when you're saying that, when you mention those different layers, it's basically you have to get a different kind of vulnerability for all those different layers to actually get through to the system to do something that's...
Yes. It's no longer one exploit. It's now a collection of like six exploits to get through.
But anyway, let's move on. Is there anything else you want to talk about in that story?
No, I think I'm done.
Okay. See the last few months talking about how bad Uber is, and you posted in our private Slack channel about describing the show and stuff. Just a real disappointment for yourself because there's a company that we've been loving to love because they're looking at electric cars and doing quite a good job, and that's Tesla. But unfortunately, there's bad news from Tesla in the realm of Uber. Bad news.
Well, yeah, and when we think of Tesla, we also think of Elon Musk. We think of the CEO because...
SpaceX, baby.
Yeah, so you have SpaceX, you have a Solar City, you have, you know...
He's just awesome. Yes. Come on, he's a superhero.
Right, and you start thinking like, oh, this is Tony Stark, you know, incarnate.
I don't think he drinks that much.
Right. But at the same time, using that Tony Stark analogy, there is also a downside, which is I was seeing...
Now, this is not specifically Elon Musk. This is his company.
Right.
So how close it is to who he is as a person or not is unknown at this point, but go on.
Right. At the same time, we have talked... at length about Uber and how the CEO has driven the culture on down. And
yes,
there are many, many accounts that Tesla and others are in some ways a cult of personality around Elon Musk.
Yes.
So the comparison.
So what's the
there.
News story about Tesla?
Well, this is talking about race-based harassment, where they are using language that we have linked to, and it's a PDF of a Superior Court filing in Alameda, a county of Alameda. So that's San Francisco area. And the comments there are ones I don't want to speak on the radio or the podcast. They are really horrible.
And they're race-based?
They're unambiguous.
Okay.
In that.
It's and not, this was employees talk to employees?
This is a manager level speaking to an employee. Ugh. And it's along the lines of why...
just harassing him or her.
But I mean, in the most ugly way, like...
Now, to be clear, at this point, this is one lawsuit?
Yes, although there have been... there have been a lot of accounts about work at Tesla not being all that rosy. Mm-hmm. So this is an extreme example. And this brings up to mind, just because we were also talking about Uber, this notion of just because a company does something that is of use, of service,
yeah. or is impressive.
Should not make them immune to critique.
Right.
And this is one where the critique is quite pressing, because it's the type of behavior that If you have any large company, there's going to be bad behavior.
Yeah.
Actually, small companies will tend to have bad behavior. But your response to that bad behavior is what defines you.
Yep.
And I don't believe that the response was anywhere near adequate, because the response should have been a swift firing.
And that didn't look like that happened. That's part of the allegations in the lawsuit.
Yes.
So we will follow this case. And, you know, I got some feedback from our Uber discussion from a couple Twitter accounts, people that were following us, saying, you know, just because Uber is doing something that's immoral doesn't make it a bad company, because companies aren't moral. They are amoral.
Mm-hmm. As much as we like to have the fiction of corporations are people.
They are not.
If they are people, they are sociopaths. They are amoral.
Yes. And at the same time, though companies can be amoral, because why would they be moral? They're a legal structure. People that run the companies don't have to use that as an excuse to act amorally. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I feel like the HR person that got the complaint
from
this employee...
Human beings have a responsibility to be humane.
First.
Yeah, and it whether you work for a company or not, it's a... human beings have a responsibility to be humane. So whether you work for a company or not, that's the bottom line.
And I would say that putting yourself and saying, well, what's best for the company is XYZ, I think it's an obligation as a human being to say, well, if I go down that train of thought, if I push the company in that way, because I'm the CEO or I have the ability to do that for some reason to make the company a certain way, or I act in regards to the company's best interest, and you do something that's immoral, that's wrong. You are wrong in doing that.
Or someone asks you to code something that is immoral, in the case of our tech industry.
Yes, and that's happening all the time.
Or
and
weld, or
it's not,
you know, solder.
In my mind, it's not good enough. It's not a good excuse to say, well, it's what my company asked me to do. It's best for the company. That's not the right way to put down what you think is best for people.
And it's not to say there isn't gray area. There's
no,
a lot of gray
totally
area.
Is. I think there totally is.
With regard to a lot of tech companies, they're pushing boundaries. And this is what we were talking about earlier with Facebook, where this is something that these social circles didn't exist before, so archiving them didn't really exist as a notion.
Sure.
You can't think about it ahead of time, because you're building as you go along. You're paving the road while you're driving on it. And so to think that you have to make traffic laws while you're making the first road just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of gray area, and we've spoken in the past before about how people of conscience need to occupy that gray area, because when they shy away from it, the people that occupy the space, because it will be occupied, are going to be people that don't have the same moral compass.
I agree. It's important to not just shy away from difficult things, but to actually try to do the best thing you can for those involved, so that you're a part of that conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. And it can be taxing. It can be tiring. And when you get ethically fatigued, as it were, maybe it is time to take a step back. But yeah, if you feel you have a good moral standing, you need to occupy the space and keep pushing things forward and exploring.
I'm not sure how much we want to talk about this, but I'll bring it up and just mention that in just a second we'll talk about Cassini, because there's something cool going on Cassini as well. But first, I wanted to mention this article from Facebook, and that's mostly because I've been paying attention to the kind of power and abilities that Facebook has over the years, and how they're you should be really conscious of what Facebook can do and how it works, because it's a large influence now in our culture. In fact, this is kind of in the thread that I didn't air last week. I didn't put in the podcast last week. But basically, there's a report of a 23-page document from the Australian Facebook office that was discovered by The Australian, a paper, but the article itself, I didn't read, it's paywalled. But the summary I'm reading from Ars Technica. And this report kind of talks about, it accounts that this 2017 document, so it's current, talks about the algorithms that allow advertisers to pinpoint different subgroups. And we covered this stories about, like, it until recently it was possible to say, I have an apartment for rent, and by the way, Facebook only advertises to white people, right?
Yeah.
That was actually possible, though illegal.
Or more specifically, don't target it to,
So anyway, it also has, it advertises to pinpoint moments when young people need a confidence boost. So basically, instead of just like, this person lives here, or this person's interested in socks, or, you know, this person makes model aircraft, all these things where it would make sense to be able to advertise, just like, hey, I have a magazine that's dedicated to people that make model aircrafts. Facebook can do that too, right? They can say, I want to post an ad to people that have the hobby of model aircrafts. And I've made these ads before. I've talked about them on Geekspeak before, because I've done it for our show, just seeing what the system was like. And this one, though, it can target people in moments of their emotional state. So this quote, moments when young people need a confidence boost, is the targeting group. Another one, and if that's not clear enough, emotional states that the company claims can estimate based on how teens use the service, including words like worthless, insecure, defeated, anxious, silly, useless, stupid, overwhelmed, stressed, and a failure. So when that person might be feeling that state, you can advertise to them. Ew. That's just my... Now,
although not a new thing, I'm thinking of the Stridex pads, for example, or the Oxy pads from our childhood.
Absolutely.
Acne, where the commercials were very much you have acne. Well, you know what? People are talking behind your back and you're never going to get a date. Like, just blatantly. And it's something that we treat teens as though they are sub-adult. We don't let them sign contracts. We don't give them certain responsibilities. We, in fact, take away the ability to make decisions in many regards because of their status as a minor.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we subject them to ads that are as targeted and effective on adults as they would be on younger, underdeveloped brains.
Right.
And that's apparently fine.
Right. Of course, it's, you know, the responsibility of the parent to protect the child from this kind of thing. So in any case, it's clear from this Australian article that Facebook, and, you know, in some ways it makes sense that Facebook would try to sell this, because, of course, if there's a company that makes a training exercise, you know, app, right, and they can target a young person that is, you know, wanting to look good and have and work on their body confidence, like that's the state they're currently in, that's the perfect consumer for this company that's selling a service that does that. Just like if you found out that people were hungry, you'd want to sell them restaurant ads, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you want to give them restaurant ads. So it makes sense. And the issue, of course, is that...
Or finding out that someone has a gambling problem, then you target them with online poker ads. Oh, wait, that would be
inappropriate.
Unethical. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of this at some level is unethical, but you just kind of touched upon a point, is that, is advertising ethical? Not to individuals, but to children. Like, it's a gray area whether our overabundance of advertising thrusted upon ourselves is a healthy thing to do. But to a child that doesn't have the filters, obviously it's not a good thing
to
do.
Or have the experience. Yeah,
have the experience. The reason why we accept that it's okay for you to advertise to us is because we're adults and we can figure it out. And even though the truth is that we're highly underrating the ability for others to influence our motivations. So much so that we end up buying that stupid drink because we were told to.
Right.
And it happens all the time. So anyway, when we bring up these things about Facebook, the problem for me always exists of, I know people I like that work for Facebook. They're awesome people. Mm-hmm. They like what they're doing.
Yep.
They are doing good. And this is going on. And I know that there's no one going, this is an evil thing, right? There's this idea of, well, you know, if there's a teen that's depressed and we can give them an ad for this thing that helps them, isn't that a good thing? At some level, yes. But when you really look at the power of your influence, especially under minors, right? We're talking about teenagers. Mm-hmm. Most of them are minors, you know, 14 to 17 in the U.S. at least.
Teen starts 13. At 13. Yeah, 13. Yeah.
This actually says 14 and so on. I think it's because I think Facebook's policy is that you have to be 14 to start. And I'm only guessing that because my daughters don't have Facebook accounts. My son does. And the age difference, 14, would be in the middle of that. So in any case, I found this a little disheartening, but not really not surprising. And be aware of this influence that Facebook has on us, especially if you've got kids involved with these services.
And Facebook allows 13-year-olds.
They do. Mm-hmm. Won't my oldest be happy soon?
You mean your second?
Oldest. Second oldest, sorry. The middle child. The oldest of the younger two? I think that's what I was doing. tell me about something fun and exciting and awesome.
It's Cassini, the name of the probe that NASA sent out years ago to track Saturn. The many moons, check out its rings. Recently just sent back images from its... from the first ever probe to dive in between the planet and the rings.
Isn't it like kind of between rings?
Yes, it is diving like through the rings. You're right.
But yeah, you're right. Going through that space. And it's funny because the description was like, will it make it and all this stuff? And I guess, yeah, it is possible for it to hit debris, but
it's very sparse.
Even like the Cassini probe is not bigger than a room. And the separation of these particles is like of the Hawaiian Islands range. You're talking about a lot of space in between this. Of course, it's possible to hit it, of course. Yeah.
Right. They look solid to us.
Right.
But then again, from way back, a galaxy looks solid, and it's so not.
Yes. Mostly empty space. In any case, this video is pretty amazing. It's a whole bunch of different stills, and there's some video. And if you haven't seen it, I recommend just doing some Google searching on Cassini. We have
and there's more to come. Yes. When Cassini actually does a dive directly into Saturn.
It's going to terminate?
Yep. And that's next year.
So kind
we'll see.
Sad, isn't
we'll
it?
See how many.
I love scientists it's are like, well, we've got the end of this. What can we do next? Let's go through the rings and hope it makes it. Let's dive into the planet.
That's awesome. Right. Awesome. Well, the dive into the planet, I think, was always in the cards for the end, and they're going to try to get as much information as they can because we don't know a lot about gas giants.
Yeah.
And about the same time, there's not a huge expectation about how long it's going to last as it goes in. Gas giants all are fairly radioactive. As you start getting larger and larger bodies, the radiation coming from them is non-trivial.
Like the largest body in our solar system, lots of radiation.
Yes, but even ones that don't have an active nuclear furnace within them, those bodies are still very bad. Like, for example, if you were to go to one of the Jovian moons, moons of Jupiter, go to Europa, on the surface, assuming that you could breathe, assuming you were in a spacesuit that could protect you from vacuum, you would still die of radiation exposure in very short order.
From Jupiter?
From Jupiter.
Wow, that's really cool. I mean, not cool, but neat. All right, we've got one more story of the official episode today, and that is of another example of robots replacing human workers. Do tell us about this robot, Mr. Elam.
Yes, this is a
ELAM.
A robotic bricklayer. And the thing about it, it costs about $500,000. But it builds or lays bricks much faster than a human does. So a human would lay about 300 to 500 bricks a day if they were experienced, if they were a professional bricklayer. This one, Sam, the semi-automated mason, can lay 800 to 1,200 bricks a day, which is more. Now, it is not without people. It's not like it goes up, drives off to the site and it does its thing. People are monitoring it. You have, for example, two attendants to it, and they are loading bricks onto a conveyor belt as it goes and does the thing. And they're also going afterwards.
Finishing touches.
Yeah. Clearing off the excess mortar.
The artistic merit of the design. So I watched
it's still still a much faster process. And
I watched this video. I didn't read any articles about it, but I watched the video. And a couple things I didn't like about the video. One is the speed at which it works is not inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, of course, is physics. It's got to move a pretty large brick. And when you lay a brick, what you've got to do first is you've got to trowel mortar onto it. And mortar is wet and heavy. And therefore, you're dealing with it bonding to the brick enough so that you can carry the brick over to the wall and place it. So you can't move extremely fast because the mass of the mortar would just rip apart in the in the momentum. So it, of course, is limited to that degree. But in general, the other thing that it did is it laid a brick, and then it laid a brick. Like, it wasn't going at a speed that was like, oh my gosh, which other tasks could, you know, if I didn't explain. It also had three people crewing it, and it clearly had to have a track laid to do this job. Like, it had wheels, but it was cleared out differently than a human space would need to be cleared out. And when you talk about how much a human can work and how much a machine can work, you can obviously say something like, a human works 8 hours a day, because that's what we do in the United States. We do 8 hour days, sometimes 12 hour days, but then you have got different rules and regulations from unions. A robot can work 24 hours a day. So the robot can do, you know, that many more hours. That's the kind of stuff people do when they say three times faster. Right. It didn't show me a robot and a human laying bricks. So I felt like it was a bit like, yeah, they're kind of pushing the numbers here. They're kind of exaggerating.
But there was something else that the robot was doing that it wasn't immediately visible from the video, which is the robot, as it's laying the brick, has a very good sense of what is level.
Yes.
Without having to, because a human, they're laying the brick and they're going to put the level down to see
Have you ever seen a really fast brick laying person?
Yes. Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
But you're right. That's a highly skilled person. You don't have to build a skill. And the skill, of course, takes 2,000 hours to build that skill. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit investment in time. But you're right that the other thing that it wasn't doing, it wasn't tamping the brick. Normally, when you lay a brick, you actually tap it down so you compress the fluids out and you get it to the right depth, right, and you put enough pressure on the molar to sink in. There it's just pushing it down to the right level, and it's perfect level, and let's go. And that is pretty amazing to see. So my critique of it is only about the headline quality of the system. In no way do I think that people will keep on laying bricks 40 years from now. No, robots will lay all bricks if we even have bricks. But we're not at the point right now where it's like all masons need to be careful. No, in 10 years you'll be replaced. Maybe it's gonna be a while.
Or the skill set is changing. You're moving toward who are people that can program these machines. Who are things that can work on those machines. But yeah, we're also talking about a society where what happens when a lot of these jobs, a lot of these tasks are shunted off to robots. How do we tackle that as a society rather than just throwing people under the bus?
Absolutely, absolutely. So this is a good reminder that all services are under threat, if you will, of massive change. That's the one thing you know about technology is that things change.
It is the beginning of the month of May. And therefore, I want to thank Chris Irwin, Pat Hedder, Jerry Devine, Jim Warner, Glenn Nelson, John Winston, Dave Holloway, David Leip, Alexis Chen, Nirajas Clenius, Tim Ramsey, Marcus Hall, Zach Smithson, John Vizana, Mike Coopersmith, Christy Ramsey, Spider Rogue, Ted Mazo, Brandon Holloway, Ben Powell, Judy Enos. And nine more wonderful people who chose to be anonymous. Thank you all for contributing to make GeekSpeak possible. And now I want to invite you to something new and fun and live. On June 19th in Santa Cruz Mountains, we are doing a live GeekSpeak episode and just a fun event. It's free. There'll be drinks, there'll be snacks, and geeky banter for all. Please come join us if you're in the area or could be in the area during June 19th, 2017. The tickets are free, but please reserve your spot so we know how many people are coming, how much stuff to buy, support people's snacking and drinking habits. Just go to live.geekspeak.org. That's live.geekspeak.org to get your free ticket. Thank you so much, and we'll see you in June 19th in Santa Cruz.
We're doing after show.
Okay. We were talking about security and site security and geekspeak.org specifically. We had a conversation online, or at least I did with Didi. No one else deigned to actually talk about my code that I was putting up online.
Didi gave reference back to your code.
She did. No, she did. I'm talking about Didi was the only one.
Yeah, because we have jobs. The rest of us have jobs. You and Didi don't have jobs.
But we were talking about security and how to do it correctly. And one of the things I did in the code for the new schema that I was working on was a password validator.
A password validator?
Yes. So that when you put in a password, that it checked to see does it fit certain basic guidelines.
So that I can't put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right. Is it a certain length? Is it? And I didn't do anything really all that
draconian.
It depends on the person. Some people would hate
them.
Yeah,
Didi's comment was, why only 8 characters?
Right. Yeah.
So, that was the minimum, of course.
Right. And I could change it to 9 or 10. And that was part of a discussion I wanted to have with folks. But it also comes down to passwords are horrible. Just
passwords
in general.
Suck.
And they are that horribleness is mitigated somewhat by tools like 1Password and LastPass.
Well, Miles, what I would want to do on the site is obviously use another authoritative answer. Just use a Google authentication. Because all of us have Google accounts, and you can do 2-factor authentication through Google, and we don't have to implement it. So if we do Google authentication, then we're set.
Right, and that's a whole other complexity layer, and that's a question of do you want to have that. The other possibility that was brought up was, for example, and this is where security comes in, where you have to say what is the target, like how big is the organization, how many people are involved, how many people need access to it, what kind of access do they need. Right now, GeekSpeak doesn't need all that much nuance.
No.
Everyone who's really involved with the show, yeah, sure, you can create an episode. Yeah, sure, create a bit, you know, create a headline, add a headline to the system, that type of thing. So there really isn't that need for great nuance, like you would at a larger company to say, like, this person has this ability and this person does not. You know, this person
right.
has the right to see people's salaries and this person does not. We don't have that type of system. None of us get salaries. So it does leave open the possibility for other things, like what if we do client certificates? Because our use case in general is we access it through our phone, our laptop.
That's it.
Maybe a tablet.
Sure.
And
but client certificates are not easy either. How do we propagate the client certificates? You have to trust the system.
That we are also so close knit that transmitting such a small amount is not that big of a deal.
You could just give me your client certificate and I could put it up.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, from that perspective, we could bake in client certificates into the Git repo.
Wait, check in client certs into
the... Yeah, the public cert in the repo.
Oh, the public cert. Sure.
Yeah,
sure,
you control
sure.
the private. The public goes into the repo.
It sure, authenticates yes, that.
I
happen.
Guess that's possible. Hadn't thought about that. You're right. It's a smaller group. But obviously, another...
Because then you don't even have to worry about logging in. You
I think
just
we should
use your system.
I think we should do Facebook authentication. Definitely.
There's also... But I mean, these are all possibilities.
Anyway, I don't know. I feel like federated authentication systems at this point make the most sense because you already have to manage that system and it's important to you. My email, my personal Gmail mm-hmm. email is really important to me. I'm going to make sure to maintain it really well. The more I can have other apps authenticate off of that and that's it, that's great. I mean, I'm all for it. I'd rather my bank go through my Gmail authentication system than have a
yeah.
password at my bank because at least I know that I'm doing 2-factor authentication correctly with Gmail. My bank, not so much. They text me and ask me my mother's maiden name. Tries the
or I think it was Fidelity at one point. I was trying to set my password and they're like, no, you can't have any special characters. Yeah. Wait, what?
Yeah. And then you were like, well, how do you log in places where you need special characters? I don't know. It's just so...
Right. Of all the places where I want a more complex password to mitigate the problems, so many financial institutions are saying, no, you're not allowed to use a more complex password.
Okay, Miles, just jump back real quick with the bricklaying thing. Why wouldn't you just have a concrete printer? Like, why even have bricks?
Well, there is also that notion of... a 3D printed house, you know, for example, yeah. a 3D printed building.
But I mean, that's bricks, what, but that's what a robotic really... brick layer is.
Yeah.
It's a 3D printer, right? It yeah. just has the pixels.
Why
of bricks?
Because bricks are a uniform size that you can use as, that you can transport easily in
segments.
Yeah,
and they're already cured. And they're saying, yeah, I get that. I'm just thinking that there's other ways of having robots build things. The reason why we don't have humans sculpt concrete walls with their hands is because it'd be a messy, horrible process. But if you're a robot, you can cure it and heat. I mean, it seems like you'd be able to do that kind of thing automatically. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, but let's not go back into that. You were saying the website that you're working on for GeekSpeak replacement, you asked for feedback and I didn't do that. So you wanted to bring that out in post show to kind of harass me about
it. No. It was just because Dee brought up that one piece and I was happy that she did. She also brought up some other aspects like timestamps and
yeah.
the funny thing of like a timestamp with a time zone versus timestamp without time zone. These are data types in the PostgreSQL database.
Right.
Actually part of the SQL spec, SQL 99 or 92, whatever. And
her question is, why aren't you holding why are you always holding UTC time codes?
Yeah, why are you having a time stamp one with a time zone?
Right.
And the answer to that is implementation specific. Like most things with databases, it's implementation specific. The types in PostgreSQL, there is no storage difference between timestamp without time zone and timestamp with time zone. The only difference is that when you store something that's flagged as with time zone, it will ask the system, what is my time zone?
The default response.
Or rather, the person who is logged in, you can set time zone within your session, your database session. And then all responses you get back are in your...
So it's almost corrected like a, it's like time a meta zone. Wrapper around it.
Yeah.
It's just an auto-translator for you, basically.
So instead of having to get stuff back in UTC and then do the shifting yourself, the database will do it for you.
So I say to the system... Save this time, and my time it's 12 p.m. and I'm saying noon. Save right. this time, and in the database because it knows I'm in Pacific, it's going to actually set it at 8 p.m. UTC.
Yes,
I guess it's not p.m. at UTC; it's 20 UTC.
Yes,
and so then when I then later say what's the time that I saved, it says 12 because again it knows that the time zone I'm in, so it always references my time zone.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay, and what's it actually saving? Milliseconds since 1970 or something?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the. The amount. Actually, it's not since 1970. PostgreSQL, it's something a lot further than that.
It doesn't matter that much. It's just an integer representing amount of milliseconds at a certain time. At Netflix, you know, we have users all over the place, all over the planet. And the time that we're sending back and forth, we have server time. And I always kind of was going, no, you got server time. I was having a conversation with somebody trying to figure out something about timing. Because we have these... On the Netflix service, sometimes you'll get what's called a billboard. It's a large canvas of an image at the top of your screen, like your website or something.
Being an HTML canvas, a drawing area.
Yeah, it's not actually an HTML canvas. It's something else, but it's divs and such, I think, in HTML. It's a React application on website. All the different platforms do it differently. But in any case, a canvas, meaning that some artistic asset area, is we call them canvases. It's a unique experience, if you will. We have one called a countdown canvas or countdown billboard. And this is for when we have a big title that we know people are going to want to watch. We did it for Daredevil. You mentioned Daredevil earlier. So a week before Daredevil came out, all of a sudden you'd get this billboard and it would say, you know, only 7 days till, and it would be this timer. And if you watched it, at the end of that time, you get to watch, you could watch Daredevil. Okay, so that timer thing, I was like, wait a second, that has to run in client code, but it's served by the server code, so how do we do this? And I was dealing with that with a person that's been there a long time, a friend of mine. He says, oh, no, it's always the same time. I was like, no, it's not the same time. The user's... No, just stop thinking about time zones.
TLDR, time is really not anything that is fixed and something
all
that you
perception.
Can build. Yeah.
It's perception all the way down.
Yeah. It is very much turtles all the way down.
Right. And so, yeah, what you really do with time stuff like that is you just, the server gives back a time and the client's rendering time, and those are the same time. And then at some point, if you need to show something to the user, like in 10 minutes, then you translate it to some kind of concept that a human might understand. But without that, it's just, it's UTC all the way down. That's what we actually do.
Universal time coordinated is UTC.
Right. And of course it makes sense because that's what you want to be able to do.
Also known as Greenwich Mean Time, but there's some difference there and it's turtled all the way down.
Was there any other code stuff you want to talk about the how are you doing on the data structure and stuff?
here's someone who hasn't looked at the GitHub.
I didn't look at the GitHub. Let me repeat. I have a job. I'm buying a house. I have three kids in school.
It's there. It's there. The functions are there. The stored procedures are there. The database structure is there. The conversion script is
Is there rendering of the site from the data structure?
No, because you told me that you wanted to work on that.
So what you're saying is it's ready for you to work on NetLile. Is that what you're saying?
it's
getting there.
There, yeah.
Cool. Does it have a converting script from the current data structure?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
That's not checked in, but yes, I do have one because it's only going to be run once. I want to have it saved, but
well, no, it's not going to be only run once. Aren't we going to run it multiple times?
I'm running it multiple times because I need to test it, but it's going to be like when we're doing the switchover.
But if we do the switchover, to do that, what we have to do, if we're going to do a one-time switchover, we have to also implement an entire CRUD system. This doesn't have a CRUD implementation, right? It just has a REST interface with CRUD.
Right.
So what you're saying is, here, Lyle, here's a data structure in a REST implementation, and make sure you only write templates?
Start writing to it because this existing system works. Write the infrastructure so that we can get basic stuff working and then switch over and then work on to the new one.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, you know that Rails application you've had running since 2004 that actually functions and does everything?
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Rebuild that.
Yeah, okay. When he says that actually functions, it was down today.
It was down today because of some other app that I ran. It has nothing to do with that app. The app is fine if I don't do anything else with it. But Miles...
That is the definition of fragility.
Okay, it's totally fragile. Fragile. But
it's brittle.
It works right now in the sense that we can edit the show and it creates a valid RSS every week. And when I upload the MP3 mm-hmm. file, it knows the length of the file and it puts that in the data structure. So the RSS feed is a valid, mm-hmm. has the length. Does your system have an RSS document? No, I have to write it. I mean, all you've done is like, you know, Rails, that really thing that's really easy to write.
Actually,
here's something else.
Actually, I have started writing templates, but no,
you have.
Yes. Yeah,
okay. But you understand my concern, right?
Yes, I do understand your concern.
So now we get to start the project. That's how it feels to me.
Yes, all those times I say, like, hey, we need to have a coding session. You're like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And Brian goes, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And
Yeah, but you understand what I'm saying. Like, Rails has been around for years. It's kind of slow and kind of clunky and really complex, but it is damn easy for me to do something in. And now I'm writing, we don't even know what the framework's going to be, right? We're going to do React yet? Or do we have to do templates in HTML?
No, it's basically mustache templates.
Okay, so we're doing mustache templates, even though it's not JavaScript behind it. It's something else. What is it?
It's Lua. Yeah.
Lua. So,
but that was the whole point. That was the whole point of the mustache templates, is because they're the same no matter what language you do.
Okay, great. So now we're going to make a static HTML document out of mustache templates, and that's a rendered output. But that's not an editor. That's not a CRUD interface.
That's true. That's true.
So then we're going to do that in anything I might choose? Is that...
I have ideas on this. If only we could sit down and
How about this? How about I quit my job?
Oh, stop.
Okay, so
by the way, as a side piece of trivia, a timestamp in PostgreSQL is from 4713 BC, somewhere thereabouts.
That's a long time ago.
To 296 AD.
That's a long
or rather,
time from now.
BC to or BCE to CE, if you want to use that terminology.
So that's the range they're using.
And
for
the resolution is 1 microsecond.
1 microsecond.
1 microsecond.
Oh, that's some good time. We just wasted a lot of that right now.
I suppose if you wanted a date is actually from 4713 BC or BCE to 5,874,897 CE at a resolution of 1 day.
1 day. Okay, because of date. So if you're saving date and time, is that two different data saves?
Well, you have date, you have time, and then you have timestamp, which is the combination of both of them.
Okay.
And a date is only 32 bits, 4 bytes.
Right.
Whereas a timestamp is 64-bit, 8 bytes. Okay. And a time...
is the combination of those two things.
Could be 8 bytes, 64-bit. Or it could be, if you want it, with a time zone attached to it, because it becomes a lot more complex with a time zone.
Just talking about time, getting tired.
Is 12 bytes.
I'm getting tired. keep going. Don't stop.
As opposed to an interval, which is 16 bytes.
Geek Species Register.
And an interval, What meaning saying an interval being this is one day or 13 minutes or a combination thereof. That allows up to 178 million years in the past to 178 million, you know, negative 178 million years to positive 178 million years at a resolution of 1 microsecond.
That's a lot of time, Betty.
I was wondering, like, why isn't time interval 16 bytes? That doesn't seem... What? And I realized, oh, in case you wanted to track the exact moment to the microsecond that the last Tyrannosaurus Rex died.
Right.
If you knew it.
And what if you want to do time after that? You have to input yourself?
Yeah, it doesn't cover when the sun is going to become a red giant.
I have this need in my home to track allowances because my kids have multiple family homes. You know, we have split families or merged families, whatever. And so I'm tracking my kids' allowances. And the basic idea is that I don't have to give them cash so that they potentially lose whatever. They just have like an account. And instead of us making like checking accounts for them, which is actually then they have to have an ATM card to pull things, blah, 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 we just have like a spreadsheet that we share amongst the parents. And I would put money into it regularly for allowances. And then we subtract money when they have their phone bill, or whatever. And so we're just kind of managing these virtual accounts. And of course, I'm using a Google spreadsheet because it was easy at the time and everyone could share it and the kids can actually view the data and stuff. But my intention was to go ahead and build like a custom app for this purpose. And, you know,
why?
Mostly because it doesn't do some things that I want it to do.
Okay.
But I settled on Google Docs because I know that actually I could do everything in there. One of the things I want to be able to do is Wednesday at noon, I want money to go into it, right? Like I want an auto entry to happen. I am sure there's someone that listening to this show right now that knows Google Docs well enough to say, oh, you can do auto insert like this. If you can, give me a Google Doc. I'm Lyle@Troxel.com if you want to share one with me that does exactly that. And I will update this and start using Google Docs. So I kind of knew that Google Doc would work. But I'm also always looking for like a side project that would be fun to work on that can try new tools and such. Of course, I could just do the GeekSpeak website, but I've been doing that for years. However, when I was looking into how to do really financial transaction stuff in JavaScript, there's not a lot of resources there. It's not necessarily the best language for that purpose. But in any case, I digress. I'll just use Google Docs and work on the GeekSpeak website with you. Are we done?
Do you
want to talk more about the tech? Or do you want to start coding?
Yeah, a funny thing as I was coding, just as an aside, just because we're venting about tech stuff. There is such a tendency to concentrate on, you have a single technology, for example, Ruby on Rails, but it could be anything. It could be Node, it could be Django, whatever. That
Django? Really?
Why not?
All right, go on.
And the notion is that you've figured out how to do it in the Ruby language or the Python language or JavaScript. And now you want to, and this was actually typified by Java back in the day, where Java was eschewing all the other code that had ever been written outside of Java that were in C and whatnot. And so there's a big push for it. There's a Java library for this. And it's a shame because there's so many just cases where there's the best tool for a job. One thing that came up when I was developing was the ability using a foreign data wrapper that's in PostgreSQL, ability to get data outside of PostgreSQL and display it as though it were a table within PostgreSQL.
You're using that for the reading of MP3 files from the file system.
Right, because one of the issues right now with the system is we have files in the file system, and then we have entries in the database.
That correlate to those files.
Hopefully they do.
And all they have... And all that's in the database is exactly what's in the file system. It's just another copy to use it.
Right. Yeah. But if you delete the file, there's no way the database knows about it. And if you lose the row in the database, then you don't have any knowledge about that either.
It's not a canonical truth.
Right. And that's what I was trying to solve, to have a view of the file system be the table that comes up when you're viewing it so that if one went away, then their view within the database also changed.
So you need an outside data source to look like a virtual table in the database.
Right. And that's what virtual data wrappers do in PostgreSQL. Or foreign data wrappers, sorry, is the term for it. Now, one of the things about those foreign data wrappers where they're looking at the file system is that, yes, I can look at the file, and it's written in Python, this one particular utility. But if I ever want to look inside the file, get the content, which can be exposed as a byte array within the database, even if I want to look just to see, this is my idea, was I wanted to look just at a little bit of the file to get a magic number terminology for figuring out what file type it is.
Or even reading the MP3 chapter information that's in the header of the file.
Because all you need is maybe some metadata. You only need the first kilobyte of it, of a multi-megabyte file. Well, it couldn't do that. It would try to load up the entire file.
Oh, you couldn't just do, you couldn't do the point, like you just couldn't read from a start a point.
And, you know, that was annoying because if you ever want to get MP3 data out of it, you're like, oh, wow, that's a 25 meg file. Every single episode, a single query through that table takes forever to build up, and you're just tanking your I/O performance.
Sure.
Your hard drive is just churning.
How do you solve it?
In addition, looking up the file stats, like here's the file, here's the size, here is the is it readable or not, you know, stuff like that, was taking a while, and that was because Python is doing a loop and saying, I want to find this file, I'm going to do this file, this file. And there is a whole lower level that can be done, which is done by many Unix utilities, such as find.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking to see, I did a basic Python app and said, like, okay, I want to read this data, and just basic information, just stat the file.
Using the Python...
the I/O library.
I/O layer, yeah.
Yeah. There's sys library, yeah. And I got a certain time. Like, I figured out, like, this is how long it takes. I'm like, you know, that's a few seconds for how many files we're dealing with. And I'm like,
So you went and tried find?
So I tried it with find. And find, you know, is a different paradigm. You're in the Unix environment. You're going to be opening up a piped stream from the shell or from the system and then parsing the output of this other program. As opposed to...
And find is highly optimized.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's still like it has that output, and then you're having to parse that output and wondering, like, how's that going to be like? And find was just ridiculous. Like,
and you're talking
about, took 3 seconds.
About in Python, executing find, getting the data back into Python, was a lot faster than using Python's libraries of file I/O.
Exactly.
That's funny. So it's not like you're like doing find direct and doing Python direct. You're having Python do find, and it's faster.
Right.
Okay, interesting.
The difference there is that Python is each loop through, it goes, okay, now I need this file, and I'm going to do a lookup on, like, first it's doing a directory. First it's doing a call to get all of the files that are in the directory. Then it goes back and says, all right, now I want to get the file handle for that file and then do the stat on it. So it's all these different operations, whereas with find, you say, one shot.
Right.
And give me everything in this directory and all the attributes I'm asking for.
And the input coming back is a very structured input. It's not like you can then say, and how big is that file? You had to ask in the beginning exactly the attributes you wanted.
Exactly.
Which means it can speed up the process.
Right.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And, does it speed up that process?
It's
the difference between having a bunch of files and in Python, it was taking something like 3 seconds to query, which... Yeah, you know, 3 seconds isn't all that long for all the information I was trying to get when you think about it as a one-off.
From a human perspective, yeah.
But from querying on the database and trying to do a join on a table, completely unacceptable.
Yeah, you know, interesting. One of the ways you can solve this, other than looking down this kind of interesting solution you're coming down with, is you can actually create a table in the database that holds the information. And every time you change the information, you change the table. Mm-hmm. So it's like a cache. That's what we have right now.
Right. No, and there is the ability to do this.
Yeah.
And that's something I had thought about, was do what's called a materialized view. You do a view of that foreign data wrapper table, and when you say materialize, you're able to refresh it so that it gives what the file system did, but it caches it, you know, yeah. for the time.
And then, you just do a read, and you're only reading that cache, and then in the background, another file.
And you can tell it periodically through a cron job or at the moment you need it, refresh this because I need that data now.
This external or remote data wrapper, external data wrapper?
Foreign data wrapper.
Foreign data wrapper protocol that you're dealing with, did you make one for Find?
That's what I was considering doing, actually. Yeah. I was looking at how to do that. Because Multicorn, which is the Python interface to doing this activity in PostgreSQL, is awesome.
Yeah.
It really is. Now, something that took 3 seconds in just using the Python library is you use Find, and you're talking on the order of milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, under 10 milliseconds.
Right.
So it starts becoming a, wow, this could have the performance of basically a standard table in the database, and it looks no different. And mm-hmm. how awesome would that be?
What's going to put the file, the MP3, on the file system? How's it going to get there?
That would be a file upload.
Through what?
Through the web browser, because you
through
have
a West, and through this a rest, is and
this
post?
Is well, this is the question. Yes, it would be a post, but is it going to be a post as in it's expecting something from form input?
Like which a multi-form part.
Yeah, post. Which multi-part forms are different than something that's like WebDAV. They're both using POST, but they have different expectations about how the data is being transmitted.
But my point is that the posting that something has to receive that. Some Lua commands can actually receive that data.
No, it's not Lua. Nginx by itself can do this.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And just throw it on, because it's just...
So since you don't have the Lua layer, you don't have an ability to...
There's an upload module, and there's a web dev module, and it's not clear which way I want to go there.
But the point here is that Nginx is going to handle the upload completely.
Yes.
The data layer, or the application layer, if you will, the very thin application layer, doesn't know anything about the upload.
Right.
And therefore, you can't write an extra table. Yeah.
Well, you
Hence
can.
Hence the desire to have this canonical truth be the file system.
Yes. But you can have it, after it finishes doing it, ping off of a URL and then have it do what it needs to do.
Just as a counterpoint to this, mm-hmm. in the MP3 file, depending on how much work I do on the MP3 file, sometimes I put chapters in there, sometimes I don't. I do the authors of the people that are on air. Mm-hmm. But there's other content that describes that file, and it's called the GeekSpeak data structure, right? Like that every week we have support from Greg Merkley mm-hmm. titling the show and stuff. We don't actually put that in the MP3 file. That's in the file system. That's like why we have, the data structure in the data structure. And then the title of the show, though it does go in the MP3 chapters, is actually also in the database layer.
Yep. As it should be.
Yeah. And there are some things that are just never going to go in the MP3. So there is definitely some truth of that file that is in the metadata of our database. Mm-hmm. But you want some of those canonical truth to be in the file. Why not just always have it like we have it now in the database?
No, the presence of the file, the length of the file, that is something that the file knows about, and that is the canonical truth. So having that in the database and where it can get out of sync, that's where I have the concern. Not that the file, like I want to read just off of the MP3, that would be horribly inefficient, but I do want it to make sure that the workflow is always one way, going from database to the file, and that the file is the ultimate arbiter of whether or not the file is there, not the database.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I get the point.
Yeah.
Cool.
Along with that, I've also been looking into things like adding the ID3 tags in JavaScript.
Yeah, there's actually not good there's not good JavaScript libraries that do the chapter mark information. I've done a lot of research around this. I have a few little side projects. Yeah, unfortunately, the chapter information protocol, which is MP3 version,
probably
3.2 version. It actually has to do with the chapters are actually they're under the namespace. I'm blanking now. There's not a real clean.
It's not lyrics.
Lyrics? No, it's not lyrics. Not lyric information. No.
Okay.
It's a different frames. They're called frames, and they can be done just generically. And then some people use them for chapters. In any case, there's not good JavaScript library to do that editing. And yes, absolutely, I would love that we keep on updating the MP3 file as we did to change the data structure. That's obviously better than the way that I'm currently doing, which is a manual hellscape. Thanks for being here this week. That was fun.
Yeah.
Coding sometime soon?
Whenever you have time. I realize you're buying a house, so I'm giving you a pass, but...
This month.
Yeah.
All right.
MILESELAM.
And I'm just Lyle, LYLE, on Twitter. And of course, you can email us at geekspeak.org and you can learn more about today's show and all the things we talked about up at geekspeak.org. Miles Elam, thank you for being here with me today.
Always a pleasure.